session number 22087, rule 1.
Alfred, you, Weldon.
Real one. Can you tell me if there was any history of military service in your family?
Yes, there was. My father in the 1914 war was in the King's Royal Rifle Corps. And later on he was in the machine gun corps when it was formed. And my brother, he, in this last war, he was in the same, in the KRRs, was my brother. And my sister was also a Wren in the Navy.
Were any of your family regular soldiers or sailors, or were they wartime only?
No, they were just during the present emergency sort of thing, you know what I mean? The DPE we was classed as, being in during the present emergency, and come out as soon as we could get out, you know. We went in because we didn't want to be overrun by Adolf, but I got sent away chasing the really Japanese.
When you were growing up, things were happening in Europe. When did you first think that Adolf might be a threat?
Well, we thought it would be when Chamberlain went to Munich and he come back waving his piece of paper, and we thought, well, it's a lot of good, is that bit of paper. He means it, he was going to... And of course, Father, by that time, he was working, he was a gamekeeper, but he'd been made redundant because of the war. And through him having military service, he'd managed to get a job as a barrack warden's labourer at the Victoria Barracks. And they knew all that was going on, all these old soldiers, you know. And he had us at home. We had to dig an air raid shelter because nobody was... We lived out in the country at Bentley, you see, 3 miles from Beverley and about 8 miles from Hull. But Father thought, well, we better have a shelter. So in the bottom of the garden, me and my brother and him, we dug this, like it was a slit trench to start with, but then it was elaborated on and made into a proper shelter with scrounged roofing and stuff, old barn, corrugated iron, and it was a real good shelter. And we used to go in there when there was a raid on. And it was lucky because they was trying to get the barracks. They got the barracks in the end, and there was every Saturday night, just around our area, landmines were dropping, you know. It fetched 52 tiles off the cottage roof, and three ceilings was down, you know. But we was in our little shelter. So that was how, you know, to deal with the military, you know.
What were you doing then when war broke out? Were you still at school or were you working?
No, I was working. I was an apprentice motor mechanic. And I don't know, I wanted to be in the Air Force. I'd been to Lettenfield and been and what around when they'd had the open days, and I liked motorbikes and engines and one thing and another, but my education let me down. There was no way I could get in among engineering in the Air Force. So the next thing was you was an ACH ground gunner. Love it or leave it, you know. I didn't like it, but that was it. I was in. And they made the best of it, because I'd volunteered.
Had you ever done any military or pre-military training when you were at school or in cadet course or anything like that?
There was none of that. No, there was cadets and all that there, but I didn't know anything about them. They had a cadet force in Beverley, but I didn't want to hear of it. I spent my spare time with the farmers, you know. My mate, a man, he had a steam engine and a thrashing machine, and his father wasn't very well, and had any spare time, could I come with him to, because it was a two-man job with the steam engine and these trailer things, you know. I said, oh, all right, Bob, I'll help you, you know, because I enjoyed it. And that's how we went on.
You volunteered for the RAF Volunteer Reserve. Did you ever contemplate joining the Army or the Navy, or was it always the Air Force?
No, the Air Force, oh, yes.
You joined them in the spring of 1940. I think.
No, 41.
41. Mm. Why was that? Was it because of your age?
Yes, I couldn't be far. I wasn't old enough, you see. Mm. I think you had to be, was it 17? I was born in 1923, so 1923.
And how did you actually go about joining the RAFVL? What did you have to do to...
I went through to Jameson Street in Hull to the recruiting office and said I wanted to join the Air Force, you know. And then from then on it was some bit of a medical, you know, cough and all the rest of it. And right, you're in. And you go then to Padgate, you see.
What happens at Padgate?
At Padgate you were sworn in on the Bible, and you received the King's Shilling. That was the volunteers. And then you were on the list as you got your number, 1099928. And you was then said that your services weren't required. There's a warrant, off you go home. And you had a little chit saying you was a member. You'd had your number and everything on. And you was a member of the RAF Volunteer Reserve. And off you went home. And we'll send for you when they want you. Well, I went home and I got a real good job with a, you know, an improver mechanic with his tar slags on lorries and that. They were busy doing the runways at Langfield. And when the time come, when my papers come, I had to go. They fought like the devil to stop me from going, did the company. But it was too late, I was already in. So off I went to Padgate. And there was a bit of form filling in and one thing or another. And then we moved off to Boston in Lincolnshire, because there was no room for to do any training at Padgate, by the sound of things. There was a train load of us left Padgate, and we went to Boston in Lincolnshire without stopping, you know. We never changed trains or anything, just this coach load of airmen, you know, all brand new.
Was there anyone you knew in that?
Only knew what I met as I was joining up. There was a kid from Mull called Albert Anderson, and his number was 1099929, and then there was a lad from Goal, Ebdale, and we were all recruited at that same place in Hull, and his number was 1099927, I think. Mine was 928. There were three of us, you know.
But where did you get your uniform? Did you get that at Padgate?
I got that at Padgate, yeah. And all he kitted out was all done at Padgate. He was kit bag and. There was knife, fork, spoon, and housewives, and you know, all the kit what you had. And then there was your own vest, pants, and socks, and all that gear, you know, everything. You didn't have any suitcases or out like that, it was all in a kit bag.
What did you think of the uniform? Was it a comfortable, practical uniform?
It was smart, I liked it. But it didn't last all that long, because in 1942 the RAF regiment came into being, and lo and behold, we was all dished out and wearing khaki battle dress.
How did khaki battle dress compare to the RAF uniform you've been wearing before?
Well, it used to ride up round your back, you know. You had the trousers, and then the blouse, and the blouse buttoned onto the back of the trousers, you know. Sometimes it would rise up and be a bit drafty. But it was this pride that got the biggest dunk, you know. We weren't Army, we was RAF, and we didn't like being Army, you know. And they drafted in Army sergeants and officers to lick us all into shape, you see, and that didn't go down very well. But when it was posted overseas, we lost all that, but it caused a bit of a surprise when we arrived in Cape Town. The people there were very kind, and they liked us, and they was queuing up with their Cadillacs at the dock gates. You boys together? Yes. Would you be my guest? And off we went. And then they said, you're not soldiers. No, we're our Air Force. Oh, you're khaki airmen. Never seen any of them before, you know. Khaki airmen.
What did they teach you during the initial training at Boston? What was on the syllabus?
Oh, the training, if I can remember right, it was you got to learn how to march, and that was the main thing, learning how to march. You know, we had a corporal, and he had a squad of about 16 or 18 blokes, and you was marching up and down, left turn, about turn, and all, you know, to the front salute and to the left salute and all such as that. And I remember one case where it was me, I was right-hand marker being tall, and when they did the about turn, I was doing a wrong thing every time, and somehow or other I was changing step on the about turn, which was not the done thing. And the corporal who was in charge, he was such a nice bloke, and I was so sorry because I could not correct his fault, you know. And one day, the flight sergeant used to come round, this was all done in the streets of Boston, Brother Tough Road area, and this sergeant come round the corner on his bike, and he bellowed out, "That man there, I'll chop your bloody foot off!" And, you know, ever after that, I never made that mistake anymore. So it just proves that you must get angry and shout if you're going to get a scene, get any process. You know, this business about, please do it, that's no good at all. You've got to have the force behind it, you know. So that was that. And we had some right fun, because they dished us out. They didn't have denims them days at, when was initial training. We had blue dungarees like the mechanics had, and they dished them out, and me, I was full of fun as usual. My overalls I had, the crutch was down again my knees, and there was a right there, but you know, well, because I was in civvy digs, and took these here to the digs, I put them on, and then I had a belt, and I made them tidy, and they went on parade, you know. And then being right marker and going all sorted out, I dropped them and let them. And this poor old corporal comes, "Well," then he says, "what on earth are you doing?" He said, "I said attention." I said, "I am at attention." I said, "My overalls are still at ease." Well, everybody laughed, you know. And that was the way it went. You made a mess of things, you know.
What were your digs like? Did they look after you?
Oh, it was marvellous. Yeah, it was Mr. and Mrs. Wade from 11 Brother Tough Road. Her husband was a big man on a railway, you know, one of the top engineers, you know, dressed up job. And of course they had a bathroom and everything. Well, I'd come from a village where we hadn't running water and with earth toilets, and our bath was a tin bath in front of the fire, you know. I thought this was marvellous, which it was, and she looked after us like a mother hen. Make sure we was fed well, you know. There was me and Ebdale, we were the two Yorkshire lads that she wanted.
So at Boston it was mainly drill. Did you have weapons issued?
Eventually we did for rifle drill, and I don't remember us doing any shooting. But we had to do rifle drill to get proficient with that, you know. And in our hats, we had the all uniform, same as anybody else, but there was loads of airfields all around Boston. They all used to come in, but they could tell who we were because we had a white disc behind our cap badge. That proved that we was rookies. So you couldn't do any shenanigans, you know. And we used to do PT, we used to get that,
Every morning?
Not every morning, no, once a week, I think it was. Wednesday afternoons or something like that. There was always Wednesday afternoon sports day, didn't matter wherever you were, they always, you know, they was keen on that.
What sort of PT did you do?
Usual keep fit stuff, you know, you've seen it on the, where your arms stretch and you sit down, stand up till you didn't know whether you was on your head or your heels, and then I let out an oath and the bloody sergeant heard me and he what did you say? I said, a lovely day, sergeant. He said, report to me tonight, he said. So I had to report to headquarters and I had some tables and forms to scrub, you know, for. And Eb Daly, he'd gone and told the landlady. She said, oh, I was in trouble with the sergeant and she was upset. I said, what are you worried about? I said, my own fault, I shouldn't have said it.
I was going to ask about the discipline, whether you found it difficult to adjust to the discipline or whether it was easy to.
No, there was no difficulty because we'd been brought up. My father was a gamekeeper for a Captain Byram. And there. The captain, he always used to like to be called captain, and you touched your cap, you know. I mean, we lived near the hall where the captain was. He was just round the corner. And that was the upbringing he had. And it was, you know, knew your place. You never spoke until you were spoken to, and it come easy. And my brother and my sister, they found the same when they went in the forces. The bringing up with dad as kids, you say, it's instilled in you and you're all right, you know.
You moved off to Scampton. What happened to you there? You say you were in 724 squadron at RAF Scampton.
That was a defence squadron, yeah. And there we were busy learning all about the different guns. The Lewis gun, we had to know its ins and outs of it. And the Vickers water cold. And them guns had to be, you had to be able to, right, we weren't all that keen. Anyway, they decided in their wisdom, did the powers that be, that until we could take the Vickers gun to pieces, strip the lock, which is rather a complicated thing, and put it all back together again, blindfolded, nobody was going on leave. So that made things. You know, you've got to get your finger out and start to do something, you know. And they got it, you know, in the end, we were all able to do it. Because, as I said, you sat there in the dark in a gun post and you have a problem with a gun. You've got to sort it without seeing. You mean, if it's moonlight, fair enough, but it could be pitch black, you know. And then while I was at Scampton, I was sent down to the a place called what did they call that place now? Dunholm Lodge. It was the satellite airfield at that time of day for Scampton, and we was living in a wood, and. The keeper's cottage was the headquarters, you know, and then we had these caravans. There was a caravan for the cookhouse, and it was a four-wheel trailer thing, you know, all petrol for cooking. The water supply was a Bowser, cold water, no hot water, and we had problems getting any water at all when it was icy because it froze up, you know, but we was fit as little fiddles. Now I was out there washing up the pans. We had the old Sawyer boilers just outside the wood, and I was busy washing these pans in my old blue dungarees, you know, and an Airspeed Oxford taxis up. The pilot was waving. Never seen an aeroplane, never had to do one, and I dropped what I was doing and went round, found the door, got in, went up to the cockpit. He says, "Are any mechanics here?" I said, "No." So he was a flight lieutenant, and all he was. "No, sir," I said, "just regiment, that's all." "Oh," I says, "you'll have to be at Scampton." He says, "just over the hill, you know." It was just out of sight from where we was. I come out, flight sergeant, "Hey, come here, you." "What have you been doing in that aeroplane?" I said, "Well, he wanted to know if we had any mechanics." And I told him we hadn't. He said, "Did he ask him for his 1250? I said, "No." He said, "Could have been a German." Well, AC plonk hadn't been in a few minutes. Asking a flight lieutenant for his... I mean, was scared stiff of a corporal. Never mind a flight lieutenant. But that daft things that happen.
When was it decided that you were going to be in a defence squadron then? Did you get posted to that at Boston?
Yes, from Boston. You were sent to the defence squadron. Because your trade, you they had all trades, you see. Trade was a ACH ground gunner.
Yeah. When did they decide that was going to be your trade? When did they put you into that job?
Oh, straight off.
What, when you signed up?
I was going to go as ACH GD, General Duties.
Yes.
But they made it into a G instead of a D.
Oh.
And once you were in that, you no way could you get out.
So you were in a category. And
they used to say, "We can get WAFs to do the driving, we can get WAFs to do the airfield repairs to the aircraft, and but we can't get WAFs to sit in gunports on a night." Ooh, that would be lovely. Hey.
So were all your squad going into that particular category?
No, there was... maybe only about three of us that went to Scampton, you know. The rest would go to different places. Some was Bright Blocks, going to be air crew and what have you know.
But of the people who went with you to Boston, did you all go on to Scampton as ground guards?
No, only two or three.
Yeah.
The rest went to other places, you know.
Right. So you went off to Scampton and you were training at Scampton, and you're also
working and training, you know. Yeah.
Working and training at the same time.
Yeah.
What did you think of the Lewis gun? You mentioned the Vickers was complicated to dismantle and...
Oh, the old Lewis strip. Gun.
No, yeah, the Lewis.
They were very slow and, they had 97 round pans on them. They originally, when they made them for the army, they only had a smaller magazine on them, but they had the big 97 on when we got them. And it was all right for what they were, you know. You used to have two of them on a pole and for ACAT purposes, but they only used to fire 500 rounds a minute, you know. And then when they did away with them and we got the Browning, they fired 1,000 rounds a minute.
When did you get the Browning? Was that while you were
We got the Browning when I was in India.
In India, not before?
No.
Mm-hmm. What about the Vickers gun then? What about the rate of fire of the Vickers?
The rate of fire was about 500 a minute with a big corner fire was the Vickers, and it would keep going forevermore. And the day after, if you keep putting the belts through, you know. Mm. And they had a water jacket on and they used to boil, you know, if there was firing a lot.
Mm. Did you do a lot of shooting while you were being trained at Scampton?
Oh yes, we did a lot of shooting down. There was a proper, we used to go down on the range, and then there was also another, for ACARC, they used to have a Tiger Moth or some aircraft thing, towing a drogue behind it. Mm. And you had, each gunner had a coloured bullets.
Yeah.
And you fired, and if your colour was on the drogue, you did it, you know. And it was a bit dodgy. There was one day the pilot played hell up. "I'm pulling this bloody thing, not pushing it," he said. Somebody had got past the drogue and going up close towards the pilot with his... So he was a bit upset.
What sort of ranges were you firing at when you were firing on the drogue? You know, what distance
I think 500 yards was that was the maximum, you know. Mm. But the memory doesn't do justice to this remembering distances, you know. Mm. You say that first off you used to be on to 50 yards, and you know, and it got bigger and bigger. And as time went on, as you got better, like, you know. Mm. Mm.
Were you ever actually Was Scampton attacked or was Dunham Lodge attacked while you were there? Whether it was only an action over the those airfields?
Yeah, because one time was there was an attack, and it was just before I got there, I think. And the ground defence force, they shot down this blinking German aircraft, you know, and they had a propeller blade in H1 block that come off the wreck of this aircraft, that, and there was a plaque and it said, I don't know what the name, whether it was Heinkel or Ju-88 or one of them German bombers, and it says the first blood that Scampton defences descended from the skies on this plaque. Where it's got to, I don't know, because I've been back to Scampton and I don't know where it is, and I belong to RAF Regiment Association and I've never seen or anybody knows anything about it, but I remember seeing it.
When you were at Scampton and Dunholm Lodge in that defence role, what were your sort of duty hours? Were you on a shift system?
You used to go on for 24 hours on and 24 hours off. And on the when you was on duty, you used to do 2 hours on and four off, two on, four off. And you'd maybe, well, there was one case, it was on there, and it come in real foggy. And I was on airfield patrol, that was with a rifle, and you went right round the perimeter. And all round the perimeter was little gun, machine gun nests, you know. And you used to ring in from each one as you went by to headquarters. And, well, there was one, it used to make me laugh, a kid called Griffiths, Taffy Griffiths, and he was from Anglesey, he could hardly speak English. And he used to say, Taffy Griffiths reporting from number 3 gun post. Well, we all had to do that, and you see, well, I was halfway round. And this Lysander come taxiing along, you know, and he stopped and he was waving, and I saw the rifle on the back and goes across. He says, can you show us where the dispersal's at? He was lost. How the hell he'd landed the thing, I don't know, but he couldn't find the dispersal. It was foggy. Well, I knew because I'd just come from there. So, and that was me with my arm inside the cockpit, stood on the stub, there's a stub wing on a Lysander, and a rifle on the other shoulder, you know, where, till he saw the trees, and I said, there you are, all right, right, oh, well, I had to walk all the way back again. I wasn't very pleased, but that was another thing that happened, you know, it was a funny thing.
When you were on patrol, were you going around on your own?
Yeah. Yeah, one man on his own, and there was men in all the gun posts. There was one man on. We were on your own, you know. You didn't have many mates like with you. So the only time when there was two of you was at night time. If you were, you know, the water tower on an airfield, don't you? Well, one of our duties was to be on the top of that water tower. We had a little hut and twin Lewis gun and a cine camera. And he was up there all day, and I was manned all the time. But as soon as dusk, doubled up, two of you was up. And he was in contact with phone to headquarters or whoever. Well, they used to ring us, we couldn't ring them. I was up there one night, me and Sam, and the ops rang. I said, hello, tower. I said, sir, can you hear any enemy aircraft? Just a minute, I'll check. So I went outside, I said to Sam, can you hear out, Sam? No, he says, he's cleared off, gone up towards Grimsby. So I went back, I says, there's no enemy aircraft noise to be heard. And I says, he's gone away towards Grimsby. Thank you, and by that, all the lights come on. And one of ours was wanting to be in. And AC2, hanging on an AC2. So much for your radar.
I was going to ask whether you often heard, whether you could tell the difference between friendly aircraft and enemy aircraft.
Oh, yes, yeah. Because the German aircraft, the twins, they never had their engines synchronised. Ours had a nice drone. Now, Jerry's, he used to go, oh, oh, oh. You maybe heard him on the telly. But that's how he could tell.
Did Did you actually open fire on enemy aircraft at all while you were at Skapton or Dunholm Lodge?
No.
You didn't?
No. No, there was strict rules. You had to wait to be